It is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2023. We welcome you to episode 90 of Tone the Slab, Pitching with David Cone. We talk pitching each and every week with the five-time World Series champ and the former Cy Young Award winner, David Cone, the research ace, James Smythe, myself, Justin Shackle. Our terrific producer, Dan Rourke, is with us as well for the ride. A lot to do this week, guys. David, you are at Citi Field in Queens for Mets Guardians on Sunday night. It was Verlander versus Bieber. But that was the back end of a doubleheader where Max Scherzer started the first game for the Mets. So did you take in all 18 innings on Sunday, my friend?
Not live, no. I watched the first half of the first game, you know, before I left my Manhattan apartment to get over to Citi Field. So, but I pretty much, you know, I keyed in. I got a chance to talk to Max Scherzer after his start. And then, you know, I've talked to Justin Verlander before. It's just a historic day when you see those two guys with those pedigrees starting. We've never seen it. We've never seen two pitchers who have won three Cy Young Awards start both ends of a doubleheader for one team. So it was really kind of history in the making. If you're a pitching geek like we are here, it was something to watch.
Yeah, and it was all the great little fun facts coming out about the dual ends of the doubleheader. They both have the three Cy Youngs, two guys with 200 wins starting both ends of a doubleheader, which hadn't happened since Tommy John and Phil Niekro with the Yankees in 1986. And most importantly for the Mets, they pitched well. 14 innings, 6 hits, 1 run, 1 walk, and 10 Ks combined in the twin bill.
I know this isn't on the rundown here, but guys, are you officially not worried about age creeping up on Scherzer? And I mean, I throw Verlander in there as well, but are you officially unalarmed with those two?
Looking at stuff, their stuff is still there. They're both still throwing the mid-90s, and Verlander showed signs of getting stronger like he always has shown in throughout his career, throughout the start, that he retains his velocity and actually creeps up a little bit, a la Nolan Ryan used to do that back in the day. So I don't see any signs at all of diminished stuff. I think it just, you know, what was the movie? Get him to the Greek, you know, for the Mets fans, it's just get him to the postseason. Get those two guys to the postseason, line them up 1-2 and take your chances.
Scherzer's ERA for the season is 4.01, but that's creeping down. And I think he is a guy who deserves the benefit of the doubt. Maybe if you're just trying to think, how's this guy going to do over the rest of the season? So promising signs out of Scherzer and Verlander, you know, he just got back. So got to think that he's still getting his feet wet under him, but I think the panic in Queens was a little early.
All right, we're going to get into plenty around the league. We're going to touch on the Blue Jays as they are in a really tough stretch right now. We're going to also piggyback an interesting article that came out of The Athletic about Madison Bumgarner. We'll look around the AL West. Also, a pair of elite pitchers who may not be performing at that exact elite level at the moment. We're going to talk about them. Look forward to a couple of intriguing series coming up this weekend. We'll get into some Yankee talk as well. But as we do each and every week, David starts us off with a topic that's on his mind in the opener. David, what do you have for us?
Well, it just seems, Shaq, that every year we need a reminder of the nature of pitching in today's game. And, you know, there's been talk on the minor league level of experimenting with a rule of tying the starting pitcher's length to the designated hitter in terms of trying to entice teams to use their starters more and to get them deeper in the games. And it's just becoming more and more difficult to do every year. We see starting pitching dropping like flies. It's hard to find good starting pitching. Seems like every other day we see somebody going on the IL with a flexor strain or some sort of an injury. And, you know, it just gets you back to how important the bullpens are today. When you're looking at the team's fate, it's the bullpen, stupid. You know, I mean, it's the first place you look. You got to look at the bullpens, how deep they are. It seems like, too, that it's, you know, the turnover, they feel like it's more fungible, so to speak. But the turnover rate every year is pretty high across the leagues. But, you know, the guys are training better than they ever have. They're gaining velocity. The training with the weighted balls, the velocity training, the pitch design training for maximum effort guys that come in for one inning, two inning max. Those are the guys that are thriving. Those are the guys that you need in your bullpen. Case in point, the Yankees. Well, we'll get into later on, but you look at some of the guys they found, nuggets here and there, whether it's a Jimmy Cordero or an Ian Hamilton or guys like that, you know, they really can determine the fate of your season. So it's all the way back to the bullpens. They're more important than they ever have been.
Absolutely. And you look at a team like the Orioles, you know, their pitching is overperformed, I think, compared to what people might have thought going into the season. And a huge part of that is that relief core. The Orioles are third in the majors on in bullpen ERA behind the Yankees and Astros. And you talk about a great find. How about Yennier Cano? Now there's a guy that they got last year in the Jorge Lopez trade, and now he's one of the best relievers in the game. It's the most volatile position year to year as far as being unable to really completely predict how these guys are going to go month to month, season to season. But you can build a bullpen with some real hidden gems.
A lot of high-priced or high-percentage lottery tickets in the relief market these days, and it's ringing true over the first, you know, month and a half here. James touched on Baltimore, part of an electric AL East. Again, every team still above 500, and you have the Toronto Blue Jays, who at 25-23, they are in last place in the division, but they have also lost five in a row, and they're in the middle of an insane stretch, and this is a stretch that's over a month long. Just want to rattle through their schedule here, and this stretch began last week. Started with the Braves, the Yankees, the Orioles. They're currently playing the Rays in Tampa Bay. Then they take on the first place Twins. They get maybe a breather with the first place Milwaukee Brewers. Then they're in Queens to take on the Mets, and then the Astros, the Twins again, the Orioles, and the Rangers. That brings them all the way till the third week in June. So they are in it right now. And we saw all the drama with the Yankees series last week during the weekend series with Baltimore. Alek Manoah had to be taken out because John Schneider didn't realize that his trip to the mound was the second of the inning. Stemming back from last year, and this is the way I feel here, it stems back to the beginning of last year. But what seems to be holding back the Blue Jays from taking that next step toward dominance? Because it seems like they have the core to do so.
They certainly do, especially offensively, when you look at that lineup, and they all have gotten off to good starts too. So I thought, okay, this is it. This is the year for the Blue Jays. But once again, the overall depth of their pitching staff, including down through the end of the bottom of their bullpen, is coming up a little bit short in my mind. You need more pieces. And, you know, back to the point on our opener. Yeah. It's volatile, as James said, you know, dead on point as usual, but also it's about the numbers. You need more to cover. You know, we talk about it every year. Who are your second five starters in your rotation? Who's starters number 6 through 10, you know, in your organization that might be in AAA or even in AA nowadays? The same on the bullpen side. You got to have volume. And it seems like the Blue Jays are caught short a little bit on the volume side, and then losing at home is a big deal for them. That, you know, the home field should be a big advantage. They have reconfigured the outfield there. Their offense should be able to take advantage of that and score a bunch of runs up there in their home ballpark. Yeah, that's a big deal when you have a bad stretch and those games all came at home last week. That's double trouble for me for the Blue Jays.
Surprising that they're just middle of the pack in run scoring with their offensive talent. And Coney, like you mentioned, I mean, they're getting big years out of Vladdy Jr. and Bo Bichette and Matt Chapman. Some disappointments out of George Springer, but you go to the pitching staff and it looks really different when Alek Manoah goes from one of the best young pitchers in the league over his first two big league seasons to what we're seeing now, where he has an ERA over 5. His walk rate has doubled and he's in Blake Snell land, where he's walking, you know, double digit, up to 15% of the batters he's facing. And they've hit on Gausman and Bassett. That's a great 1-2 punch. And going into the season, you think, okay, you have those guys with Manoah. Maybe Jose Berríos turns around. He's still lost in the woods. Yusei Kikuchi's been a useful starter in the middle of their rotation, but it's just a little thin.
I think Manoah's problems are right at the top of the list, because you mentioned some of the pitchers that we probably had questions whether or not they would have good seasons. You know, potentially Gausman. How would Bassett, assimilate to the AL East? there were some main questions with this pitching staff. Alek Manoah was not one of them. So I think, like David said, double trouble for the Blue Jays with their pitching depth, as in they don't really have much. Between some of the other stuff, you know, maybe outside the baselines, I feel like this group has this us against the world mentality for some reason. And I'm not sure what the genesis of it all is. They were up in arms over Aaron Judge and the Yankees realizing that they let their guard down. You know, they got so upset last year. I remember when Kevin Kiermaier stole the card on that play at home plate. Like, their opponents are pretty much saying, hey, this is what we're doing. What are you going to do about it? And the Blue Jays don't seem to do anything about it. I guess the lineup card at home plate, or whatever the catcher had, maybe not an equal example, but again, the reaction is similar. I feel like they spend a lot of time reacting to the hand that they're dealt, that they don't seem like they focus enough on how to just go play the hand. And it's a bad look for a core that's really talented in my eyes.
It's a young team, right? So if there's an overreaction to petty grievances, then maybe that's something where a young team would react differently than a team full of veterans.
Yeah, that's a great point. And trying to establish yourself in the American League East against, you know, the Darth Vader of the league, right? The Yankees, the evil empire. That can give you a little bit of a complex in terms of trying to make your way and establish your name. So the Blue Jays are a sleeping giant. They have the whole country behind them. Their television ratings are incredibly high. They're through the roof. Better than almost anywhere else. When they win, they have tremendous support. So, yeah, there's a lot of pressure there. You know, they feel like they, you know, they've been coming. The new stadium renovations are halfway done. You know, their owner has all the resources in the world to provide whatever they need. So, yeah, the time is now for the Blue Jays, and yet they're stumbling, and that's when the frustration comes, when there's high expectations. You're expected to take that next step, and then all of a sudden you're losing games, and you're losing games at home in front of your home crowd. That's a tough one.
But let's also remember that even with a 5-game losing streak, they're 25-23. Yes, they're in last place, but they have the same record as the Twins, who are winning their division. So I think a lot of you saw this too with the Yankees early in the year when they were banged up and they were in last place, even though they had a winning record. And there were times where they had a better record than the Central leader. The AL East is so crazy good right now that a 3-game winning streak, a 3-game losing streak, or a stretch where you win 6 out of 7 or lose 6 out of 7, you can turn the whole standings upside down.
More Toe in the Slab is coming up. But for all the men out there, I need to tell you about a way you could step up your skincare. And that is something that the earlier you start, the easier it is to maintain. And Caldera Lab is here to help you raise the bar with your skincare. This company creates high performance men's skincare products by combining pharmaceutical grade science along with nature's purest and most potent ingredients. You want to go the all natural route, believe me. Caldera Lab is backed by a leading clinical trial where 9 out of 10 men experienced healthier and visible improved skin. Caldera Lab has tools to unlock your best first impression and confidence. One of the main things that the females notice first is a man's skin. The Regimen Bundle from Caldera Lab, a twice-a-day routine to transform your skin. Inside this bundle, you're going to find the Clean Slate. It's a balancing cleanser that uses gentle plant-based cleansing. The moisturizers called the Base Layer. It's a nutrient defense fortifying moisturizer. Huge on hydration for the skin. And then the Good, their go-to at night before bed, and a clinically proven multifunctional scrub that helps your skin look tighter and smoother, as well as to help reduce visibility of wrinkles and fine lines, talking about the creases underneath your nose, the crow's feet by your eyes, the wrinkles on your forehead. You want to take your skin game to the next level. You could do it with Caldera Lab. Look no further than the icon as well. It's the serum for your eyes. It is here to address the three most common skin concerns around the eyes. Like we mentioned, the crow's feet, the fine lines, and also you want to eliminate those bags, the dark circles, the puffiness underneath your eyes. We have a great code for you. It is SLAB. And if you enter that at calderalab.com, you will get 20% off your order. That is 20% off at calderalab.com by using code SLAB, Unlock your youthful glow and be ready for summer with Caldera Lab.
All right, there was an article, guys, in The Athletic that came out on Monday by Zach Buchanan, and it centered around what led to the divorce between the Diamondbacks and veteran pitcher Madison Bumgarner. And to kind of just sum it up here, you have a pitcher who has a lot of miles on his arm and sort of distanced himself, and there was a resistance for him to change his approach in order to maybe offset the aging arm. And he was resistant to changes that were provided to him from the Diamondbacks team pitching staff, felt like he wanted to kind of do things his way. Almost at times, it sounded like he was doubling down on what it took to get him to that point, to the highest points of his career with the Giants. And eventually the Diamondbacks said, all right, we're going to let Madison try and figure it out on himself. It obviously wasn't working. They decided the best way to go about it was to split amicably. Everybody has great things to say about Madison Bumgarner, but the approach is something that they had a big disagreement over. So we know that no one's really, I don't know if maybe there have been phone calls to Madison Bumgarner, something that we don't know for sure. But if you are a team, giving a call to Madison Bumgarner, based on what we learned in this article, what are you saying to him if you're potentially interested in bringing him aboard on your squad?
Well, I think it would have to come from a voice of reason and somebody he trusted. So maybe somebody like Bruce Bochy in Texas, who has a significant history with him and would allow him to speak his language, so to speak. You know, we know really from reports out of Arizona that they're a very progressively run team. Dan Heron, the former pitcher, kind of helps with their scouting reports as the pitching coordinator, so to speak, and comes up with detailed scouting reports, both for the pitchers and the catchers. And the catchers wear those wristbands. You know, we see it around the league that they're kind of referring to throughout the course of each individual at bat. That's sort of a script for catchers to follow in terms of pitch calling. On certain counts against certain hitters, here's your choices on pitches. If you deviate from that, you will be second-guessed after the game by your pitching coordinator or by whoever runs that department will come in and say, you deviated 16 times from the suggested signals that we, you know, or the pitches that we had suggested for you. Why did you do that? And that's something that goes against what Madison Bumgarner is all about. He would not thrive in that kind of a situation, a very progressive, modern approach to pitching. He's as old school as it gets. That's part of the problem in the article, obviously, and his ability or willingness to adapt, to try different things, to throw different pitches, to be open-minded. Did he give up too soon? We don't know, but moving forward, it's got to be somebody that has an old school approach. And when you look at Texas, you have also Mike Maddox there as well. So that's the kind of tandem that can talk or speak Madison Bumgarner's language, develop some sort of trust with him to give him another shot. But secondly, he still is going to have to make adjustments. He's going to have to show something different because his velocity and his skills and the quality on his pitches has diminished.
I would think of one name, CC Sabathia. He was someone who was a star pitcher who had lost velocity and had degraded into one of the worst regular starting pitchers in the game from, say, 2013 to 2015. But he reinvented himself. And from age 35 on, from 2016 on, he was an above average starting pitcher, and he was consistently going, you know, 150 innings a year. And he was the anchor of an up-and-coming young Yankee team, the start of this baby bombers era in 2017. He was the ballast in the rotation there. And he was someone who, you know, kind of learned on the fly. It took him a while, but he saved his career, because the thing that's going to end up getting him into the Hall of Fame, I think he'll end up in Cooperstown, isn't necessarily the Cy Youngs and the World Championships. It's that stretch where he was still able to be good until age 38, and he was able to hit milestones like 250 wins and 3,000 strikeouts. He bent that aging curve a bit, and he was able to reinvent himself. Now, one stretch from the article, which I do recommend, as Shaq mentioned, but as his velocity and command began to dip, Brent Strom, the pitching coach from Houston, and the organization pushed Bumgarner to use the cutter far less and boost the usage of his curveball and changeup. Bumgarner, who sources say became obsessed with regaining his fastball velocity rather than adapt to the pitcher he was in the present, remained unconvinced. That it's not surprising to hear Madison Bumgarner be stubborn like that, but it's got it has to be that open-mindedness and thinking like, this is how I can be more of a pitcher as your skills and velocity degrade.
That line stuck out to me too, James, being obsessed with regaining his fastball velocity. All the math and the science is pointing toward that not happening. So yeah, I thought of CC Sabathia's turnaround as well. Before him, Andy Pettit, obviously we're in that, you know, Yankee prism here. So we're seeing a lot of things through a pinstripe prism, but those are the two names that jumped out to me as well as examples where Madison Bumgarner probably has the ability to turn this around. I think David hit the nail on the head, and I was at a loss for a team for a while until David mentioned Bruce Bochy and the Rangers. So maybe that does make sense, and we'll see if Texas does in fact give a guy like Madison Bumgarner a call. Speaking of the Rangers in first place, they are clinging to first place at the moment due to the red hot Houston Astros. But what we are seeing in the AL West is some of the best individual starting pitching performances of this young season. So it leads me to the question of who is the best starting pitcher in the AL West right now?
Wow, that's a tough one, you know, because there's a new entry. I'm a huge fan of Seattle's overall pitching staff, really top to bottom. And some of the best stuff is going on in Seattle. I don't know if you've seen this kid Bryce Miller throw yet, but wow, he's something. I think he's a potential game changer for them to give them the overall depth in their rotation that they need. Man, that's, you still got to look at Shohei Ohtani and what he does. And just as the unicorn, as somebody that's just, it's such an outlier. He's so talented that we're still kind of processing what we're watching with this guy year in and year out. So it's hard to bet against Shohei Ohtani, but you know, watch out for some young entries up in Seattle there that are going to have something to say about what happens in that division on down the stretch.
I'm going to go with Ohtani, and that's not even counting his bat. He's, I think it's almost where he's this unique part of his game. You kind of lose how great he is just as a pitcher. So I'm going to stick with Shohei there, but this is a great exercise because there are so many great starting pitchers in that division. Luis Castillo in Seattle, Framber Valdez in Houston. You go with two other guys on those staffs. You could go with George Kirby and Christian Javier. It's great pitching top to bottom. And how about you talk about the first place Rangers, Nathan Eovaldi with his recent scoreless streak.
Yeah, I think that accentuates like the right now part of the question, Nathan Eovaldi's resurgence here for the first place Rangers, but you're right. And it's so strange because it feels like such a tough decision, yet it also feels like Ohtani's the slam dunk choice. So I probably in not wanting to go against the great Ohtani, you know, pick him. But if I had to go with a 1AA really close, probably at this moment, Framber Valdez with the Astros. He kind of just, you know, like a lot of these pitchers, he just goes out and posts each and every time. And I'm not saying again, like the others don't, but feels like there's just been like zero doubt that he will be the arm that you could count on every single turn through the rotation since the start of last season. So for the fact that he's done this in a very large sample size now, I think for me probably puts him above the rest, just a slight amount, but right in back of Ohtani all the same. So this is a tough question. I don't think there's any right answer here. It's a matter of preference, a matter of choice. But yeah, you definitely don't want to go up against Shohei Ohtani. Speaking of other aces here, over toward the National League, you have Corbin Burnes and Sandy Alcantara. I don't want to say pitching below expectations. I mean, Alcantara probably is more so than Burnes, but they're just not at their elite levels that we're accustomed to here. I'm wondering which team needs their ace to return to that dominant form a little bit more. Is it the Brewers with Corbin Burnes, or is it the Marlins with Sandy Alcantara?
Off the top of my head, I gotta feel like it's Corbin Burnes in Milwaukee. You know, their division in the Central's up for grabs. you know, Miami's got to play in a tougher division in the National League East with several contenders up and down. Sandy Alcantara, when you think about the World Classic, the World Baseball Classic, he really expended a lot of energy in those games. He was throwing 99 miles an hour his first start. I'm not sure if that had an impact or not, even though it wasn't from a quantity standpoint, a lot of innings or a lot of outings. But you talk about, boy, high-intensity pitches that he threw in the month of March, about halfway through March. But that makes me a little suspect with him. Maybe he needs a little bit of a break, miss a start. Maybe the All-Star break recharges him a little bit. But with all that being said, it's got to be Corbin Burns because Milwaukee's the team that should win that division. And they can't do it without him at the top. And they've had some issues, too, with the overall depth of their rotation as well. So they need him even more than ever before right now.
I like that pick. Milwaukee also missing Brandon Woodruff. That's a big absence. Now, Burns, yeah, he hasn't been at a, you know, Cy Young type level like he's been. He gave up 5 runs in his last start. But overall, a 3.97 ERA isn't that much cause for alarm. You look at Sandy now, he's had some blow-up games that really inflate the ERA, but he has a 5.05 ERA. And you look at where the Brewers and Marlins are, I'm a bit more of a believer in the Brewers to win the Central, to make the playoffs or what have you. And so that's why I think I'll go with Alcantara, because I feel like the Marlins, they're on the fringe as it is, let alone in the East, but more as a wild card contender. And I think that they're toast without Sandy being at his best. So I'm going to go with Alcantara there.
Yeah, I want to say the Marlins because I want to give them a shot. And they've had a nice surprising start, around a 500 team. And it's an uninspiring National League so far when you think about the expanded playoff landscape. But look, their offense needs to be doing better. Alcantara is not going to solve their lineup issues here. They aside from Arise, they really don't hit a lot. And if they stay the way they are offensively, it probably won't matter that Alcantara is bringing things like his walk rate, his line drive rates down. So, yeah, for me, it's the Brewers. Milwaukee's 5-5 in the starts made by Corbin Burns. Like James said, there's not so much alarm here. I think he's, you know, pitching, I don't want to say average, but, you know, 3.97 ERA is not something to be ashamed of for sure. His walk rate is higher than normal. He's been giving up more fly balls, which perhaps has led to more home runs. I know the Astros tattooed him the other night. If Corbin Burns is healthy and elite, while the rest of the pieces in that Brewer rotation may not be, that still might be enough for Milwaukee to grab the NL Central. So yeah, it's a lot to ask for a guy who's been elite for a few years now to continue to be elite. It obviously takes a strain on your arm. That workload has to catch up to you at some point, but that's just kind of how thin the margin for error is in the NL Central. So I'm going to go with the Brewers and Corbin Burns there.
Yeah, you look at their fielder independent pitching, which, mm-hmm. you know, is another layer to peel back to see exactly what the pitcher's doing by himself. Corbin Burns, FIP, 4.82. Sandy's is 3.5 in the 3.5 range. So when you're trying to sort of, okay, who's really doing what here? Corbin Burns is the guy who's giving up more home runs, more walks, more hits this year. That 4.82 FIP is a red flag out there. And that's something that he can control. You know, fielder, you know, as James knows, fielder independent pitching is set on the scale to ERA. So you can compare, and it's just what the pitcher does: home runs, strikeouts, walks, and hit batters. You know, just things that are completely in the pitcher's control. Sandy's better than you think.
For Burns, the home run rate is ticked up, but it is a little alarming to see his strikeout rate go from about 30% last year down under 22%, which is even below MLB average, which is very much unlike Burns. So just something we'll have to monitor moving forward. And one quickie thing on the Marlins, you mentioned the offense, Shaq. I'm just curious, what is the best batting average for a guy who played for a team that was dead last in scoring for a season? Because the Marlins are 30th among 30 teams with 3.48 runs per game. And that's with Luis Arraez hitting 383.
You're probably going to have a potential batting champ be on a team with arguably the worst offense, which is wild to think about.
Yo, what's up, guys? Producer Dan here to let you know that with the baseball season in full swing, DraftKings Sportsbook has got you covered for all this season's action. And right now, new customers can place a $5 bet and get $150 in bonus bets instantly. Plus, everyone can hit one out of the park with DraftKings stepped-up same-game parlays. Boost your winnings with each leg you add up to 100%. Join the big league action now on DraftKings Sportsbook. Download the app and sign up with code SLAB. New customers can bet just $5 and get $150 in bonus bets instantly. Only at DraftKings Sportsbook with promo code SLAB. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. In Massachusetts, call 800-327-5050 or visit gamblinghelpline.org. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY. Kansas, call 1-800-522-4700. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort, 21 plus in most eligible states, but varies by jurisdiction. See DraftKings.com/sportsbook for details and state-specific responsible gambling resources.
All right, guys, we have a lot of intriguing series this week, but I'm looking toward the weekend here. There are two in particular that get the juices flowing here. Dodgers, Rays, obviously. Very intriguing. I believe that's happening in Tampa Bay at the Trop. So Dodgers Rays there. And the Rangers and the Orioles piqued my interest. Which weekend series you think will tell us more about the teams in those two series?
I haven't seen the pitching matchups yet, but the Dodgers are calling up their super prospect in Bobby Miller. Cannot wait to see him throw. Upper 90s fastball, four pitches, all of them potentially above average. You know, I don't say that lightly. You know, major league pitcher, starting pitcher, if you have two pitches that are above average and then a third pitch that's average, say a changeup or something of that ilk, you're in pretty good shape. So when you start throwing around four plus above average pitches for this kid, that's something to watch. So I'm not sure if he's pitching this weekend or not. I know he was just called up. So he's a guy I got to see pitch. Bobby Miller, love to get him on the podcast at some point. But as far as the overall series, the up-and-comers kind of intrigue me. Baltimore's the story. The Orioles, are they for real? You know, we've seen this come. We saw them make a big leap last year, and we're like, okay, are they going to level off this year? They're going to keep coming. They are. They have tremendous talent, a young nucleus of talent. James mentioned the back end of their bullpen with Cano and Bautista. Baltimore's a team. I mean, they play the Yankees this week and then this weekend. But with each passing series, it's like, wow, you know, this team's not going away. So playing Texas, I mean, that might be a good read for them too. Two teams that are up and comers and that have high expectations. So I kind of got to give them the edge, although I got to see Bobby Miller pitch.
Well, Miller is making his major league debut on Tuesday in Atlanta against Spencer Strider. So there's a juicy pitching matchup for you. Now the Dodgers do have an off day on Thursday. So he might be able to pitch on Sunday, or do they just give everyone an extra day and then Miller misses that Rays series at the Trop? We'll see how that shakes out as the week goes on. But I'm going to go with Texas and Baltimore too, just because, you know, they're new teams. They're new up-and-coming teams, and it's a good test because you think, well, how for real is Texas? Are they going to be able to – how much longer are they going to be able to hold off the Astros? This is a good test for them. And the Orioles, they racked up some wins early. They took advantage of a soft schedule. Well, now they've been playing a much better caliber team lately. They won two out of three against the Rays. They just swept the Blue Jays in Toronto. They have three games at Yankee Stadium, another good test here. So this is a big stretch for them, a six-game road trip in Toronto and New York, 3-for-3 so far. And then they come back home for the Rangers starting on Friday. So it's going to be a really interesting series to see how these two measure up.
I'm with you. Going with the Orioles, Rangers. I'm a firm believer in what the Orioles are doing, and I don't think there will be much of a drop off the rest of the way. And there is one reason for that. Adley Rutschman is the second best player in this division, next to Aaron Judge. So you're going to have Rutschman and Judge in the same series this week. That's my opinion, and I really believe that as long as Adley Rutschman is a healthy player and producing at the level, I guess, that's expected of him now, the Orioles are going to be in playoff contention pretty much his entire career. Like, that's how much I think of Adley Rutschman. he is their Buster Posey. So I am a firm believer in what the Orioles have done. I feel like they're for real. I'm more intrigued to see how the Rangers go about facing this type of team, because just glancing at their schedule, I don't know if the Rangers have necessarily caught a team, an opponent, when they're in a heater, so to speak. Like they saw the Yankees at a weak point. They may have faced the Astros, and they want, I know they won a series at Houston, but the Astros didn't get off to such a blazing start. So I'm wondering how the Rangers respond here against a team that's playing really well, with the fact that you now have the Astros breathing down their neck. So I think we're going to learn a lot about the Texas Rangers. That's what I'm intrigued to see here this weekend, how the Rangers go about facing the Orioles.
Yeah, Seager's back too, their shortstop, mm-hmm. which is a big deal for them, and great player in the middle of their order. DeGrom's throwing bullpens. He's not back yet. Now that's going to go a long way, obviously, towards Texas's future and how much he can give the rest of the way as well. But Seager's a really, really big part of their lineup in the middle right there, and having him back helps a lot.
All right, let's get to some of our Yankee chat topics here, guys. Over the weekend, Yankees swept the Reds. They're facing the Orioles here this week, but I feel like they pulled off an important Band-Aid over their recent road trip. They went 6-1 on a 7-game road trip. They DFA'd Aaron Hicks. What did we learn about the Yankees after they parted ways with Hicks with 3 years left on his deal?
What we found out is kind of consistent with Brian Cashman's philosophy. If there's a better option out there, if they weigh all their pieces, they go through their process, and they make a determination that the trade for Greg Allen for Aaron Hicks made their team better because of Allen's potential speed element added to the lineup, pinch running, defense, switch hitter. They just felt like he, at this point in their careers, that Greg Allen was a more viable option for what they needed on their roster. And even though Aaron Hicks had started to swing the bat better over the last week or so of his tenure, I think overall speed plays, the athleticism plays. Greg Allen sitting in AAA with 23 for 23 stolen bases, and I think a 780 OPS plus in AAA. That guy needs to be in the big leagues. And even though it was Boston, the Yankees had to give up a really good young arm, an 18-year-old that's got really good stuff. You know, it's hard to project 18-year-olds by the time they get to the big leagues, but nonetheless, the Yankees gave up some quality in order to get Greg Allen. They wouldn't have done that if they didn't feel he was an upgrade. That was their process. That was their determination. And Greg Allen's made an immediate impact just with his athleticism. And it's nice to have that kind of athlete on the bench if you're Aaron Boone, because he can do a lot of different things, play all over the outfield, pinch run, switch hitter.
The Hicks move was just a matter of time, really, right, guys? So whether it was this weekend or down the line when someone like Giancarlo Stanton gets back, creating that roster crunch, I've long been a Hicks defender. I think he never got his just due when he had several good years with the Yankees. From 2017 to 2020, he was a top five center fielder in the game. People think I'm crazy for saying that, but he was fifth in home runs. He was fifth in on-base percentage. He was fifth in slugging. He was fifth in WAR among MLB center fielders over a 4-year stretch, even with some missed time. So as good as he was then, the last 3 years have not been good, and he really drew the ire of the fan base. Some of that I think was unfair, like getting booed during the baseline intros on opening day. But at the end of these 3 seasons since 2021, a .209 batting average, a .625 OPS, an OPS plus of just 78. It's not going to cut it. And I think it was, whether it happened this weekend, a week from now, or 2 weeks from now, I think it was just it was inevitable that this is how it was going to go.
I want to bring in Dan Rourke for some fan perspective here, because a lot of what James just said, I agree with. You know, I don't think anyone should be booed on baseline intros during opening day. I feel like the Yankee fan base in recent seasons, they're always, you know, there's someone on their mind where they want blood from at all times. And as soon as they parted ways with Hicks, it felt like a portion of the fan base was like turned their attention to, okay, who's next? You know, who's next to go? Like, I don't know if you necessarily should be operating that way, but I am in lockstep with you, James. For a time, you know, before 2020, Aaron Hicks was one of the best center fielders in the game. I remember there was a time where, like, I know he led off a few times, but I was like, man, I'm intrigued to see, like, what would the lineup be like if Aaron Hicks was batting second. Like, that's how good of a player he was at one point. Dan, do you think it's lost on some Yankee fans that Aaron Hicks was once that good of a player for this organization?
Yeah, I think people do forget. I mean, even like you were saying, James, at the time they forgot too. I mean, I always would go back to in 2018, Aaron Hicks finished, I believe, second in WAR next to Mike Trout. And I would always say, okay, that means he's what, the second best center fielder in baseball? He really was for a good while. And, you know, I was calling for the DFA of Aaron Hicks. It was quite obvious it was time to move on. But, you know, once it happens, the deed is done. So I was kind of past, like, dogging on the guy. And looking back, you know, he had some good moments, some big moments. You know, even going back to last year, the three-run homer tied up against Houston. I think in 2019, his homer against Verlander in ALCS Game 5, one of the more badass moments I can remember in recent Yankee history. And we thought the dude was done for the year, pretty much. And then all of a sudden comes back, hits that big homer, and, you know, some weird shit's not going on. Who knows what happens in that series. But, yeah, I think it was obvious for them to move on. I want to actually give credit more so to Hal Steinbrenner, because, you know, there was an article I think that came out last week mentioning how, you know, money's not going to be a factor. If they can put the best team on the product, like, that's what they're going to do. And between this, between, you know, not so much with the money thing, but putting best team in the field, you know, the Volpe decision as well. A lot of things are going on in the past year that if there's an issue with the Yankee front office that the fans have, I don't think it should be anything to do with Hal Steinbrenner, really. Because I think he's doing his part. He's putting, you know, enough money into the team. He's not letting, you know, money be the reason why he doesn't put the best product on the field. So props to him. I wonder if maybe the same thing happens with Donaldson towards the end of the year. We'll see what happens there. But yeah, to answer your question, I think definitely people miss or like undervalued Aaron Hicks, but I also think it's reasonable with how bad he's looked over the last 3 years. It's not like he just had a slight drop off. I mean, he was pretty bad. So I get it from both sides.
Yeah, I think it was a move that had to be made. I think it was only a matter of time. Hicks kind of, you know, admitted to it at the end. He's like, I understand it's a business. You know, now I need to move on to the next chapter. He also said, you know, he loved being a Yankee. It was the best part of his career. But the writing was on the wall there. And yeah, but between bringing Volpe up for opening day and a move like this, where they're still owing a lot of money to a player and cutting ties with them, I think those are two big examples of, you know, from a fan's perspective, like, oh, this Yankees organization is operating just a little bit differently than what we've become accustomed to in recent years. So they're doing the necessary moves for this team to have the best 26-man roster, period. And I think Greg Allen's addition, again, makes this this lineup rotation a little bit more multidimensional. So, I think obviously it was the right time to part ways with Hicks. And we move on. David touched on the bullpens around the league in the opener, just the markets for relievers. There's a lot of promise involved there. When I take a look at this Yankee bullpen on the stat sheets, you have seven different relievers having saves this season. And we're in the middle of May right now. So you mentioned some names, David, but overall, what has made this bullpen group this season so versatile?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Shaq, in terms of you talk about teams have been gearing this way for a long time. At least analytics departments have geared this way of, you know, a three-run save in the ninth inning can be a bit overrated against the bottom of the order, and that we've been moving towards this sort of high-leverage situation. Use your best assets and the identifying the best time to use them, the high leverage spots. Use your best assets. If your best relief pitcher comes in the seventh inning with the first and second nobody out, that might be the best time to bring him. The game will be lost if you wait for him to pitch the ninth inning. That might not never come. And the Yankees are probably more than any other bullpen in the big leagues right now have adapted to that modern usage mentality. And even they're using that terminology amongst themselves, the pitchers themselves, of, you know, they're trying to identify the best high leverage spots. For Clay Holmes in Toronto, it was first and second in the seventh inning and nobody out, and he gets out of it. The next night he might pitch the ninth inning. They've got these interchangeable parts that is really the envy of every analytics department in the big leagues over the last 10 years. This is what we've been talking about. This is what we want. You need these guys to be able to fill multiple roles and to have a day off, a day of rest, and be able to plug somebody else into that high leverage spot. And the Yankees are, they have that better than anybody. In my mind, Wandy can close the game. Marinaccio can close the game. Obviously, Michael King can close the game. The list goes on and on. And then on the front end, they've incorporated that starter, that opener strategy with Cordero. I think that is the next level stuff for them. They can do that moving forward, even with Clark Schmidt in certain situations. They can use an opener strategy with Jimmy Cordero, who's upper 90s, heavy sinker, heavy slider. If you've got a right-handed dominant lineup at the top of the order, Jimmy Cordero is a perfect opener for the Yankees. So they are well-positioned moving forward to get the most out of their bullpen that they possibly can with interchangeable parts and high leverage spots.
Coming off of the off day, going into the start of the Orioles series, the Yankees have a 2.87 bullpen ERA, best in the major leagues. They're third in opponent average. They're sixth in opponent slugging. They have the highest ground ball rate, and they're sixth in homers per nine. Top to bottom, this group has been fantastic. Even with injuries, this is a team that doesn't have Jonathan Loaisiga for most of the season, and they haven't missed a beat. Even Clay Holmes, who has drawn a lot of ire for a couple of shaky games earlier in the season, he's been great over the last few weeks, 9 1/3 scoreless innings over his last nine appearances over the last 3 weeks, 9 1/3 innings, 13 Ks, only three walks. So it looks like he's cleaned up the control issues he had early in the year. And yeah, he was getting saves, but during this stretch, he's been pitching a lot in the seventh and eighth inning. So you have him coming in. I think the unique ability of Michael King and to an extent Ron Marinaccio to go multiple innings if needed has kind of opened up some other things. Teams, not just the Yankees, teams have been really mindful of pitching guys back to back, tracking that, making sure guys, if a guy goes multiple innings, maybe he gets one or even 2 days off the next day. So if you have games where you use Michael King for two innings and then he's out for at least 1 day, maybe two, then that kind of says, all right, well, who's available today? Who isn't? And these moving parts, when you have eight guys in a bullpen, who's high leverage, who's low leverage. And this is, every team has to deal with it this way. The Yankees are navigating it very well.
Yeah, a lot of people want to point fingers at coaches and managers when it's not going right. I think you need to tip your cap to Aaron Boone and Matt Blake for guiding the bullpen management the way they have over this stretch. And again, you could look at this schedule. This bullpen is producing, and they're kind of doing it on fumes here. The Yankees have four off days between opening day and June 1st. I mean, they have four off days in the first 2 weeks of June. So they are literally pitching on fumes right now. And Aaron Boone and Matt Blake, they're pressing all the right buttons. Obviously, the relievers are posting the results and doing a great job in this difficult time. They're picking one another up. Low leverage guys are sometimes forced to pitch in high leverage situations, and they're coming through. What they've been able to do with their availability, or limited availability at that, based on the schedule that they're forced to play through over the first 2 months of the season, I think is really remarkable. And that's why I feel like there's even higher promise as we move along here this summer.
Agreed, because they're going to get more guys back. Tommy Canley on the mend, going to be back. And then by the end of the year, you hope Jonathan Loaisiga comes back. So, yes, I mean, if you look at it, if you just want to say, okay, you set a check, high leverage, low leverage relievers identified. The Yankees have five high leverage guys right now. If you think about it, King, Wandy, Marinaccio, Holmes, and Cordero are all considered, you know, a seventh inning on, you got a spot, you'd feel comfortable using any one of those five guys. So if you get Canley back, you're getting healthy, you start thinking about the Yankees might have the most high leverage or the best core of potential high leverage guys.
All right, guys, reaching the end of the episode here. We're going to land the plane. One final thought. David, where are you going to be at this weekend for Sunday Night Baseball?
We're going to get Spencer Strider in Atlanta. Ooh. So we get to go down to Atlanta and see the Braves. So we're pretty excited about that.
Who are they facing off?
Who are they facing? We are the Phillies. Phillies and the Braves. So it should be good. We don't know exactly what the pitching matchup is on the Philly side as of yet, but we know through the grapevine, through Buster Olney, who does a great job for us there on the reporting side. Seems like we're going to get Spencer Strider Sunday night.
That's enough for the marquee right there over Sunday Night Baseball. Spencer Strider and the Braves in action against the Phillies. So we'll be sure to watch David there along with Carl Ravitch and Eduardo Perez. That is going to do it for this episode, guys. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel so you don't miss a beat on what we are streaming each and every week here on Toeing the Slab. For David Cone, for James Smythe, for our terrific producer, Dan Rourke, this is Justin Shackle. We will talk to you next week on Toeing the Slab, Pitching with David Cone, a production of John Boy Media. Take care, everybody.